Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talking Logistics, where we have conversations with thought leaders and newsmakers in the supply chain logistics industry. It's my great pleasure to welcome today's program, Derek Muhlenberg, who is Manager of Optimization Services at Lean Logistics. And today we're going to talk about supply chain optimization, four key steps to achieving an optimal transportation network. Certainly transportation is a topic as we head into 2016 here that's going to be top of mind for a lot of logistics executives, particularly with the way the economy is going. You know, what's happening with oil prices, so on and so forth. And, you know, optimization is one of those topics that, you know, has a lot of meaning for a lot of different folks. And certainly that's one of the key questions we're going to ask. I'm going to ask Derek here to kind of go into and really, you know, talk about what role optimization plays in helping companies, make sure that their transportation operations are running as efficiently and are keeping up with the rapid changes in the industry. If you're joining us live today, certainly one of our goals here at Talking Logistics is to make this conversational. So if you've got a question or a comment for Derek as we're having our conversation here, you can do so via the post a question button, and I'll certainly keep an eye on that. And if it's a good and appropriate question, I'll try to weave it into the conversation. So with that, Derek, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Adrian. I'm excited to talk about the stuff that I love to do.
Great. Well, Derek, you're a first time guest here on Talking Logistics, and you're officially our first guest of 2016. So we're excited to kick off another great season of great conversations on supply chain and logistics topics. But when I bring on a new guest, I always like to learn a little bit about how they got involved in the industry. So, why don't we start there? Why don't you briefly tell us a little bit about your career path, how and why you got involved in supply chain and logistics, and what your current role and responsibilities are there at Lean Logistics?
Sure. So if we go way back to when I was in college, I actually started as a MIS major, so Management Information Systems. So my roots are in data manipulation and computers. I was fortunate enough to not have graduated yet when the dot-com bubble burst. And at that time, I decided maybe I should diversify my portfolio. So I added a supply chain to that. And turned out to be a really great marriage of data and the practice of looking at that data, finding opportunities, and helping companies save money. So with that, I started my career at Caterpillar, working on the inbound side. So dealing with suppliers, purchase orders, collaboration, unique experience. Caterpillar is obviously a very large company. Got to see a lot of things that maybe you don't have an appreciation for the scale of an operation that large. Then I moved on to work at Menlo Logistics, which is now XPO. Did a lot of work over there with a manufacturer of banking equipment. Got to see a completely different side of manufacturing, very niche. Helped them a lot with network modeling, some transportation simulation. And that's where I really started to get into the kind of things that I work with today, which are systems, modeling, benchmarking, looking at all the different sources of data we have now. People have ERPs and TMSs and all these things that really weren't that prevalent just only 10 years ago.
Now, great background. You want to add something else?
Oh, I was going to say, and my role here at Lean is to help the customers that use our technology help get the same kind of results. So we have all this data from all of our customers. We can do analytics and help people save money in their supply chain.
No, great. I was just going to say, great, diverse background there, starting working with a very large company there with Caterpillar, the 3PL space, now a technology managed services space. And certainly that foundation in data and how data can lead to, insights, right? And then using that technology, because the reality is, when you talk about optimization, really at the heart of it is that its supply chains have become so complex, and transportation in particular has become so complex, that you really can't do it with spreadsheets and, whiteboards. And I guess you could, but you're not really going to be as effective as you can, in today's, very dynamic environment. So let's talk now about the topic, and let's talk about supply chain optimization. Like I said in my opening remarks, it's a very widely used term in the industry, but I find that, if you ask 10 people what it means, you'll probably get 10 different answers. How do you define it, supply chain optimization?
I like to think of it in four categories, and one of them is really a separation of the same idea. The first one, everybody knows about benchmarking, comparing yourself to like peers, determining how you're performing, right? So that's the base. I'd say everybody's pretty familiar with that. The next would be transportation simulation, and that's going to be talking about routing level decisions, looking at discrete orders, what happened historically, what if I could change my transportation modes, how much money could I save? And then I'd say the third and fourth are network design and supply chain modeling. And those kind of go hand in hand. One's really just a more specific version of the other. So we talk about network modeling. You might look at things like facility location analysis, customer assignment. And when I think of network design, it's more of an aggregate. What can I do not just with the existing footprint I have today, but what if I make a drastic change? If I produce something at a different facility? If I need to determine which customers are most profitable? Things like that.
Right. So, I mean, you really highlighted, four steps there. And really that goes back to kind of the title that we're of this episode, right? So, four key steps. You talked about, the benchmarking, the modeling, the simulation, the network design. So let's talk about those steps, a little bit. I mean, what type of, for each of those steps, I mean, what type of data, tools and resources are required to perform those steps?
Mm-hmm. So I'd say probably the least resource intensive is benchmarking. The two key things I'd say for benchmarking is you have to have your data in a clean format that's usable and reliable, right? Often I see shippers that procure freight on an all-in basis, and you can't really separate fuel. So that's a large variable that kind of complicates the whole exercise. So you gotta have clean data, and then you have to know what you're comparing and if that's reasonable. If I'm a $10 million shipper, I can't expect to achieve the same rates on the market as a $100 million shipper. So there's a little bit of common sense along with the science. For simulation, unsurprisingly, it's data again. This time it's really granular, because when we're simulating something, we need to know, we want to get a very accurate answer to determine not what might work, but what would work based on the constraints that we have. So we need to know information about the freight, the size, the cube, the pick date, the drop date, how it was executed historically, and then we need to also have a good rate basis and rate matrix to look at all the different possible ways of moving that freight through the network. When we talk about network modeling and design, since those terms are so broad, most of it is determined based on what the true scope of the model is going to be. Generally, you have an idea of a particular answer you want to get so that you can build the model. That's going to control what data is going to go in there. At a minimum, you're going to need to know your customers, your products, what they're demanding, and then what facilities can produce those products and how they can be distributed to the network. If you want to get really granular, you can start talking about things like intercompany transfer pricing, taxes, duties, inventory carrying costs, a whole realm of different variables you can put in there as the next step in modeling.
Now do you find that gathering all that data and making sure that it's quality data, that it's useful data, as being kind of the more difficult or labor intensive part of the projects that you do, does that take longer than the actual analysis and running of the models and building of the models?
I'd say without a doubt, yes. The data gathering of the project is by far the largest effort. I think it's gotten a little better as time has gone on, with people get more and more systems. almost everyone now has a WMS. They didn't have that before. A lot of shippers have TMSs. Most shippers have some form of ERP, so we can get demand data. The hard part is often tying all of those together. So historically, we would have had to go and get all this stuff in Excel, hire an army of interns to type in all this stuff off paper invoices, right? This is not that arduous any longer, but there's still a lot of art in determining what data is useful and how to combine those from these disparate systems.
Right. Now, I've been a big proponent for a long time of network-based solutions, because I think that helps facilitate, you know, that data gathering and data collection, right? So obviously, Lean Logistics has a network-based, you know, solution where you've got multiple shippers and multiple carriers and multiple, you know, trading partners all on that network. And for something like benchmarking, you know, I've always seen that as a valuable value add of a network solution, right? Is that, you know, the ability to be able to aggregate that data to do that, you know, whether it's the benchmarking or to help facilitate, you know, network design, network optimization to, you know, to facilitate that data gathering. I mean, is that something you're seeing, obviously, as part of the network environment that you operate in?
Absolutely. I think what helps a lot is not only the system, but it's really the process that's enabled by the system. So fields have a purpose. There's a process that's followed to fill them out. You can kind of draw a line in the sand that says, this is the minimum amount of data I can expect to have in here, because these are the milestones that enable the system to work. So you can always put in more data, but you can't put in less than this minimum amount. So you can always count on those key fields being available and, for the most part, comparable, because everyone's following the same process from order to delivery.
Yeah, no, you know, great point. You know, are you seeing, you know, companies building, you know, supply chain optimization capabilities in-house, or are they relying on, you know, 3PLs and managed services providers or a combination of both? I mean, with the clients you work with, I mean, what do you see there?
I've seen both. I'd say I see more partnerships than I do building of center of excellence. There's strengths and weaknesses to both of them. Obviously, if you're going to build your own team internally, that's a lot of capital you have to put up in terms of purchasing the software and then hiring and staffing that group and keeping them isolated from day to day so that they can actually get that kind of work done. Conversely, when you're working with a service provider, you have to make sure they understand your business, they have the correct data, and that they're going to be around the next time you want to run the model.
Yeah, good point. You brought up something that kind of leads me to my next question. You said, you know, if you're building it in-house, you want to make sure you have to staff it with folks that are really going to be almost full time to this, right? That they're not going to be, you know, pulled in multiple different directions, particularly with kind of day to day, execution, let's say. I mean, are you seeing companies performing, you know, supply chain optimization, you know, the four steps that we talked about on a more frequent basis today than in the past? And if so, what factors are driving it?
I think I do see it happening more frequently. One of the big things is mergers and acquisitions, right? In the past, we go back, companies kind of were what they were and they did what they did. And it seems like every day somebody's being purchased by another company, or they're combining and they're trying to find these synergies, right? And to your point earlier, supply chains today are not like they used to be. It's not make to stock. Everything's not in the warehouse. We've got e-commerce. We've got multi-channel. We've got all these different business units within these conglomerated corporations. And you can't wrap your head around, how can I save money and rationalize this? There comes a tipping point where you need to have some solutions and bring a data-based approach in terms of measuring, how can I improve this? And what are the areas I need to look at? What are the areas I don't need to look at? Another one of those is the Amazon effect, right? Everybody says, well, I can go on Amazon and I can order this laptop and it'll be there in 2 days. That stuff's trickling down to things that are much more complex than the delivery of a laptop. So businesses need to be agile and keep that in mind. How can they do that, and how can you determine what the cost is going to be? You want to be pretty accurate about that. And the best way to do that is to actually model it out.
No, great point. You know, one of my predictions that I made back in December 2014, leading into last year, was that supply chain design was going to become more of a continuous business process as opposed to something that was done, you know, ad hoc or maybe once a year type of thing. And I certainly saw that, you know, happening, you know, last year. And I see that happening, you know, moving forward for, you know, the reasons you just explained. I've also seen it from a risk management standpoint. For example, you know, when you look at things like, you know, the port shutting down or the Panama Canal coming online, or, you know, things that might be happening from a currency standpoint or trade agreements, so on and so forth. I think a lot of companies are taking that proactive action to kind of do the modeling, do the simulation, run all these what-if scenarios ahead of time, so that if any of these scenarios actually come true, they've already done the analysis, they already have thought through the potential, that future state environment, and they could already have defined some actions to take. Do you see that as well from kind of a risk management standpoint, kind of doing some of these proactive, I should say, you know, analysis and modeling in light of what could happen down the road?
Yeah, and I think a perfect example that I remember distinctly, I've always been into computers, when the tsunami hit, right? It wiped out a large portion of the world's hard drive production capacity. They were heavily constrained because they were all made over in Asia, and there really was no redundancy, and that had a ripple effect for years and years. And that's a single point of failure that other companies might not be able to weather out, right? If you're going to switch to somebody else because they have it available, that's going to put a dent in your finances, right? So you want to be able to forecast what's going to happen. So yeah, I've seen more of that. The weather closures, the port strikes, labor issues, like you said. All those sort of deals.
Yeah, no, that's a great example there with the tsunami. Certainly that was something that, particularly for companies in that industry, you know, was a very disruptive, you know, event. So let's talk in that about, you know, kind of developing, you know, the business case for supply chain optimization, whether you're going to build this in-house, the capabilities in-house, or whether you're going to partner with someone to augment your capabilities or provide this as a service. I mean, how do you develop the business case and ultimately measure its results?
So I think one of the first things that's helpful in making the case that modeling needs to be done is that you can't say whether or not something's a good idea until you've measured the size of the prize, right? A company might say, well, there's no way I'd move my distribution center in this place because we've had it there for years and the service is great and we like our service provider. You could run a model and it could come and say you could save 30% if you moved it. I think the answer might be a little different if you have hard data backing it up instead of just intuition and history. So the first one is you have to measure it in order to know what it is. Along with that, if you don't have a baseline, you really can't tell if you're improving. So when you run a model, you give yourself the ability to isolate variables within your supply chain. It's easier for me to come and say, well, we saved a lot of money this year, and I attributed to packaging changes. Was it really packaging changes? Was it lower fuel? Did the transportation group do a good job? Did the procurement group do a good job this year, right? If you can't isolate those individual variables in the supply chain, it becomes challenging to defend your position and to make a case for specific improvements that can help save money for the enterprise.
Now, great points there. I mean, one of the things that I also see, and I'm interested in your take, I mean, sometimes a lot of folks think, you know, particularly with the network design piece, is they think about, well, that's going to require a lot of capital of investment, right? So if we're talking about, you know, when they equate network design with and supply chain optimization with, you know, opening up new warehouses and closing warehouses and, you know, importing from somewhere else versus somewhere else. And a lot of those possible scenarios are, you know, are carry relatively high level of risk. There could be some capital costs required. It could take, you know, a year or more to fully implement. So a lot of folks, you know, and certainly you might see more of that with a merger and acquisition, you know, as companies try to rationalize their supply chain. But I think a lot of companies fail to recognize that a lot of times with these models and simulations and network design exercises, even benchmarking, you know, the four steps we talked about, there are a lot of, you know, more limited, lower risk, you know, a smaller bang for the buck type of projects or actions that can be taken that have a real business value that maybe it might just be, you know, you might want to just flow product, you know, differently instead of from one existing distribution center, flow it through a different another existing one, right, to save on transportation costs, let's say, because you picked up a new customer somewhere. So I think, do you see that sometimes maybe companies have, you know, they think of supply chain optimization as involving, you know, large capital expense, very disruptive type projects, and fail to see that there might be some lower risk, you know, more achievable short-term opportunities at hand?
Yeah, and I think it's incumbent upon us as practitioners of supply chain modeling to help explain that upfront during the scoping process, right? Modeling can be whatever you want it to be. I've run point solution models where they say, I don't want you to look at anything except for the fact that I need to add a new distribution center on the West Coast. Can you tell me where it should be? Sure, right? We need a limited amount of data to do that. And honestly, that's a good return on their investment. Say they're gonna spend, they're gonna sign a $1 million lease, right? Wouldn't you wanna spend a small amount to verify that it's gonna be in the right spot? We've done models for customers where we've just looked at customer assignment. So to your point, flow analysis, right? Should these customers be assigned plant direct? Do they have the volume to do that? Should they go through a pooling location? Customers that have, redundant production capability where they can make the same SKU in more than one location. If you have a different conversion cost in each location, how do you know what that mix is, right? We're not asking the question about, do we close a plant? Could we move a line or could we move some of that capacity around in order to enable savings in another avenue?
Those are great examples, and that was going to be my next question. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that or not. My next question was really can you share with us some use cases or some, you know, customer examples, kind of illustrating supply chain optimization in action? I mean, you gave some there. Any others that come to mind?
Yeah. So the one that I was referring to with they have two plants, and they can make almost the same SKUs in both of the plants. And one of the plants is almost always at capacity because it has a lower conversion cost due to its proximity to the rail. And the ultimate question is always, which customers do I assign to that plant? Which customers do I assign to the other plant? And what products should be manufactured at each of these plants? And beyond that, what products should I have a co-packer make? When does that make sense? The unit cost might be more, but I could save money in inventory, could save money in transportation. So when you start getting to that third and fourth echelon, the math becomes a lot fuzzier in your head about how do I save money and how do I make sure this is the right decision. Think back on another model we did. It was a global model where they had three different manufacturing facilities, and we had to look at things like country of origin and the impact on taxes and duties. So is it always cheapest to serve a customer from their local manufacturing center, Or are there some financial incentives to serve them from a different plan? One of the findings from that model was that they actually reshored a major component that was being sourced from China back into the U.S. The unit cost was something around 30% higher, but net-net, it ended up being a savings due to taxes, inventory, obsolescence, things of that nature. You can find some surprising answers that you wouldn't necessarily see just looking at the surface of the data.
Right. I think those examples also illustrate just, you know, how complex this analysis can be, right? And when you look at kind of the changing environment out there, you look at what's happening with interest rates now and the potential changes that can happen, you know, this year, you know, what's happening with transportation costs and fuel costs. You know, you talk duties and taxes, and that's always a moving environment with, depending on what free trade agreements get ratified and if, companies put in punitive tariffs, so on and so forth. So, it's certainly a complex analysis. And, you know, sometimes, like you said, you know, the opportunities may not be, clearly evident on the surface. You really have to, you know, take the time to do this analysis. And sometimes you find results that may not be intuitive, but, can provide some dramatic benefits. Derek, we're running short on time here, so I'm just going to go to as a way to wrap up. What questions should supply chain and executives ask themselves to determine and assess if they're a leader or a laggard when it comes to supply chain optimization, and what kind of actions can they take today to move up the maturity curve?
Mm-hmm. I think obviously the first one is, have we ever done a supply chain modeling exercise in any form or fashion? I think most people have probably done benchmarking. A lot of people have probably done transportation simulation, and I'd say a smaller subset have done network design. And if you have done network design, do you have a process in place to make sure that happens on a periodic basis? I think the value you get from network modeling, transportation simulation, is not in a one-time effort. It's through continuous improvement, building your baseline, familiarizing the business with the types of analytics, data, information that you can glean from these types of models that can provide them insights that they maybe don't have today just looking at regular financials. Through that, you can ask some of the tough questions about risk mitigation, disaster recovery, tricky things about customer service. What if we launch a new product? What if we gain or lose customers? The ability to evaluate all of these scenarios with a high degree of confidence in the results. And that doesn't come from one modeling effort. It comes from people seeing the results, measuring the changes that have been implemented, seeing those work, and then believing in the process. Because at the end of the day, it's a tool. But we have to have faith in the process and the outputs in order to make those actions happen.
No, I absolutely. I think, underscoring that piece, that it is a process. It's more than technology, and obviously people are an important part of that overall solution set as well. You really need to have folks that understand how to leverage the data, how to build those models, and how to make sense of the analysis. Derek, like I always say, at the end of these episodes, we always just manage to kind of scratch the surface on these topics, but I think we did a good job today in terms of getting the conversation started. So I want to thank you for, taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
We didn't get any questions live, but, if you do have a question for Derek and you're watching this episode on demand, you can watch, you can find the episode on talkinglogistics.com and post your question or comment there. And I'm sure Derek will be more than happy to respond via that medium. So again, thank you all for joining us today and look forward to seeing you in a future episode of Talking Logistics. Have a great day.